I think it's important for people to always recognize, why is the customer there? Why are they coming to you? What's that core value? And I think if you lose sight of that, I think there's going to be problems further down the line.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons critical for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experiences and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. 2020 has been a year of extraordinary unpredictability. And with the next U.S. presidential election in November, and no COVID-19 vaccine yet available, stability is still beyond the horizon. There are a myriad of unknowns, but we've invited three experts to share their experiences and help shed light on what might lie ahead. Joining us today are Dr. Scott Latham, author, business commentator, and professor at the Manning School of Business at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Pat LaPointe, venture capitalist and current managing director of the Montana-based Frontier Angels Investment Network, and Michelle Huey, entrepreneur and CEO of Vim and Vigor, a compression legwear company based in Missoula, Montana. How does a business adapt to stay afloat? What are the steps you should be taking right now? Where can you turn for help? On today's episode of Can Do, we're asking our guests these questions and much more. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Michelle, Scott, Pat, welcome to the first show of the new season of Can Do. We have a lot to discuss today, so I wanted to get right into it. Scott, you have written and commented widely on organizational decline, innovation, and success factors in businesses. How has the pandemic and the economic disruption affected what you normally observe?
It's a great question. And unfortunately, one of the observations that I made a month ago, and I don't think it's unique to Boston, is starting to bear out. Arnie, I'm sure you know this, but for your audience's benefit, I have studied in depth the dot-com recession, the Great Recession, and now I guess what we're going to call the COVID recession. And this one truly is unique, largely because there's the health component. And I think there's a significant behavioral component to this as well that is really inducing some hurting effect going on in the population. There is going to be what I would call a very jagged recovery. And that will take potentially, you know, two steps forward and one step back. The reason being for that is because you're going to see, and I'm not a big fan of this phrase, until we get a vaccine, better therapeutics, and a better understanding of the disease, hotspots emerge in a very unpredicted fashion that are going to hamper any sustained economic recovery. So for this recession, unlike the Great Recession, which saw a prolonged recovery, and then the dot-com recession, which was a little more robust, I have no faith that that's going to be the case. And the companies that hurts the most are the small startups. I do a lot of work here with medical device, digital health, and I had also an opportunity reading to Michelle's background, reading some of the stuff that Pat had written on health on his background. And one of the articles that Pat wrote about when I was in the chair as an entrepreneur in 01, 08, this is what I would tell an entrepreneur today. Boy, was that dead on. And it's foreign to them because these are people that are passionate about their technology, their companies, their market, their customers. You better know your burn rate. You better know your books. And especially with this recession, especially.
Pat, what's the state of angel and venture investment in general and in Montana particularly?
Angel investing is thriving. It's actually up on all material indicators over the first 6 months of the year compared to the prior 6 months or the same period year ago. Angel groups are reporting growth in their memberships, which is really surprising given that so many of our angels tend to be entrepreneurs themselves, and many of whom are obviously suffering but also in terms of dollars invested, the metrics are actually up materially year over year, including for our group here in Montana, Arnie.
You're involved with 40 investments. What are you hearing from them about what's going on?
Well, it's a mix. And the metaphor that we grasped onto a little bit was sort of looking at the world in terms of surfers, swimmers, and sinkers. You know, roughly a third of the companies that we've invested in, either because somehow the shifts in buying patterns in the current pandemic have benefited them, or simply because they're doing something that is, as of yet, immune to the effects of the pandemic. They're doing great, amazing. In fact, we've had two successful exits in our portfolio just within the last 90 days from companies that are doing really well. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, we have a couple that are struggling to stay alive, and I would say maybe half of those are struggling in direct relationship to the pandemic. So figure maybe, you know, 15% of our portfolio is clearly struggling because of the pandemic. And then everybody in between who's just trying to figure out which end is up and trying to stay alive and keep the cash flow heart beating.
Speaking on that issue, Michelle, Vim & Vigor has been growing over the past several years since you started it. You have been in 1,100 retail outlets. What sort of havoc has the past 6 months played with your business?
Yeah.
What adjustments have you had to make?
Yeah, I mean, tons. I mean, March was kind of an oh crap moment, you know, especially when retailers started canceling all their orders and the entire economy shut down. And at that, you just had to react. It's you conserving cash. You have to take a look at your P&L. You're trying to manage cash flow and really cut expenses as quickly as possible, because for any small companies, you don't have cash to burn. You don't have money in the savings account to be able to weather that, where you have like Microsoft with, you know, 3 years of operating expenses in their bank account. You know, you don't have that type of leverage and liquidity. And so it's really been a matter of really tightening up all our belts, knowing every single penny in, every single penny out. And there's just so many, as Pat mentioned, so many kind of binary responses to this. You either have incredible opportunity, whether if you're selling toilet paper or an alcohol, you're crushing it, or you're really, really struggling and trying to really figure out how to pivot. It's been 5 to 6 months in, and the only thing that I know is that it's impossible to plan. You know, all the assumptions that we used to have with working on your strategic plans, knowing when the seasonality is going to hit for any type of product, was so fairly predictable before, and where the revenue channels were going to come in. And now it's really unpredictable. We're planning month to month. We're not planning quarter or annually or having a 3-year plan the way we used to. It's just really, really crazy. Obviously, in terms of my business, I sell in brick and mortar stores. I sell online, and every obviously everything has been accelerated to kind of that online space. But that also puts a strain on the ecosystem for online businesses. There are obviously sustainability considerations with that as well. And so even if businesses are crushing it and doing well, there are still challenges that they're facing regardless. And it's just really, really unpredictable.
Your supply chain stretches all the way to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Have there been disruptions?
Luckily, no, from a supply chain standpoint, because I have a really strong relationship that I go there, you know, once a year to visit with them. And Taiwan has done a very, very great job of containing the virus and done a fantastic job. So I haven't had considerable supply chain issues, but I'm one of the lucky ones because I have tons of friends who have. What's happening from a supply chain standpoint is it's having an effect all across the board, because even suppliers who can produce now, things are opened up, are so gun shy because about 4 or 5 months ago, they had all these orders cancel on them. And so, you know, even though we're seeing the economy open up a little bit more, I think supply chain is going to continue to be an issue, and it's based completely on cash flow and liquidity and just being really overly cautious of the uncertainty of not knowing whether they should go all in. That happened in retail. In 2000, the Great Recession of 2008, especially in apparel, you had this huge recession that happened, And a lot of suppliers were holding on to a ton of inventory. And that's not, that wasn't long ago. You know, a lot of those businesses are still in business now. And that wasn't that long ago where they do not want to repeat that. That's really where all these flash sale sites started to pop up, you know, because there was so much inventory in the market. And, you know, suppliers don't want to make that mistake again.
The stock market keeps chugging along, even though 30 million Americans are collecting unemployment. The economy contracted by an annualized rate of 33% last quarter, paralleling numbers of the Great Recession. I think most people think the stock market reflects economic prosperity. What's going on here? Pat, Scott, you want to take a shot at that?
I'll take a shot. I don't share that sentiment. I think Main Street and Wall Street, there's not the linkages that there may have been 20, 30 years ago. I think if you look at Wall Street right now, I think 90% of the trades are largely automated. There's only about a third of the U.S. population that has a significant holding, largely through 403s and 401s. I think the stock market likes certainty. I don't understand why at this point in time it is being as stable as it is, because all I see in the market is uncertainty. I have personally shifted my portfolio. So Arnie, I know it may not be the most insightful answer, and a lot of it might have been an academic with a firm grasp of the obvious, but right now I don't believe there's a strong tie between the day-to-day economic fate of most Americans in Wall Street. I just don't.
Pat.
I completely agree with Scott's statement and that the ties between Wall Street and Main Street are really no longer solid. However, I actually do believe that the stock market reflects economic prosperity, but only if one looks at it in a long-term arc. And what I mean by that is, essentially, the stock market is a reflection of the fact that there is so much money looking for any kind of return, and it has no place else to go other than into the stock market. No other really liquid place to go other than in the stock market. And what that's done is it's changed the risk return curve, meaning that investors are willing to expose themselves more to a downside in order to just be able to say that their money's actually working. So the market's become very inelastic, regardless of what happens day to day, month to month, in the otherwise historically predictive economic indicators. The market just keeps chugging along because, Arnie, there's just gazillions of dollars flowing into it.
You know, we need to create 30 million new jobs. Either old jobs that have been terminated have to be rekindled, or new jobs need to be brought online. Where are they going to come from?
Innovation. Disrupted patterns of living, disrupted patterns of doing business create tremendous need for innovation. And it's always in times like this that new industries get born, new technologies get developed. And so while it's easy for us right now to sit back and point to curves of industry sectors that have historically been good employers that are really declining and in some cases declining rapidly, it's harder for us to see the hundreds of new curves that are being born right now because it's a little too early. That's where the jobs are going to come from.
Scott.
So again, I agree. If I could go back, and I've been taking notes on both Pat and Michelle's comments, you know, the surfers, swimmers, and sinkers. I do think it's important to get away from what Michelle called the binary response. There is a differential effect going on here. I was involved in a large-scale study, literally wrapping up as COVID hit, and looking at digital health and the healthcare cluster and future of work technologies, blockchain, AI, robotics, and seeing how they were transforming the sector. And then COVID hit, and basically that survey data and our analysis, right now I don't know how to make heads nor tails of it, but around the differential coming into that, I would have told a young adult to go into AI, that AI was going to be this huge field that was going to explode over the next couple of years. Now, as I look at the data, now as I talk to people, I still think AI is going to pop, but I think it may be pushed out a little. But I think some things, the best example, telemed, for example, that's being pulled forward. So I think you have to look at the industry sector. You have to look where the innovation is going to be pushed out, where it's going to be pulled forward, and then, you know, plan your career appropriately, because that's where the jobs are going to be created. One more cross-sector observation. I wouldn't tell a Boston grad to go into financial services right now. I wouldn't. I think financial services is largely not a dying industry, but if you look at State Street here locally about 6 months ago, they cut 1,500 high-level jobs, largely because of AI. So I think it has to, you have to look at the industry, and then in the industry, you have to see where those disruptive curves, as Pat called them, are going to emerge.
Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, for me, one thing that I am seeing, and I think we're going to see even more, is when we're talking about the industries, I think we're getting back to basics, right? We're going back to food, agriculture, health. I think where we're going to see the biggest forms of innovation are actually going to be from very basic human needs, right? Because if you look at what's happened over the past couple of months, that's what's been the most disrupted, right? And I think that that's the exciting thing. Getting back to, like, Scott, what you're saying of what business to go into, agriculture, sustainability, but maybe doing it in a different way. And that's where I think we're going to see a ton of innovation. I think another component of where the jobs are going to come from is remote work. People aren't requiring people to live in a particular area to employ them. And so I think the jobs traditionally that I've never, ever seen allowing for remote work now has remote optional, because if you're going to get people to interview and partake in those jobs, you have to offer that. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see where people are going to get talent from in kind of less geographic areas and more kind of just decentralized areas. And that'll be also affording more opportunities from that as well.
Pat, is that how your portfolio companies are reacting to the COVID situation?
Well, I think, Arnie, entrepreneurs are opportunists by nature. And, you know, wherever they sense there may be a vacuum, they'll rush to see if it's worth filling. And so we're seeing a big rush right now of companies that are doing sustainable food production, sustainable food chain. We're seeing, as mentioned, just a flood of companies who are tinkering around with the digitization of healthcare delivery, not just, you know, data, but delivery. And also another big one is EdTech. God, I can't go 2 hours right these days without being pitched by another EdTech company. And Scott, you know, get ready, because that's coming head on into your industry now, right? It's going to be harder and harder for universities to justify paying very high salaries to a lot of tenured faculty when that same amount of creative intelligence can be applied across a much broader audience through different delivery mechanisms, you know? So those are the kinds of things we're seeing. But generally speaking, you can count on entrepreneurs to just find the places where the pain is. And then you have to figure out whether or not it's actually worth building a solution there, but they find them.
Yeah. If I could, Arnie, you know, and again, Michelle had commented on it. I think for me, I've seen this shift. 6 months ago, it was kind of dot-com-ish. Everyone had the next big app and they were looking to hit a home run, something that was going to transform everything. And then I think it has shifted more around these basic cost savings, efficiencies. I don't know that people have the risk or trust appetite for disruptive technology right now. And I was, yesterday I saw this one that fascinated me, and you may have seen it. It was this company called Alphabyte, and it's an AI company that uses scanning technology that literally scans salmon fish farms for lice. Like, it scans their scales. And the benefit isn't there. It's not this superhuman salmon that's 10 times bigger and 10 times the meat. It's a cost savings, because it basically helps save healthy salmon. And I don't know. I think there is a lot more of that type of innovation that's going to occur, to Michelle's point, around the cost savings. And in the ed tech, boy, Pat, I'll tell you, that's you want to talk about heads in the sand in higher ed? Oh, boy, they just don't get it. Starting with the faculty. And again, I've been a dean, I've been a vice provost, and ed tech over the next 10 years is going to transform the way we deliver education.
Yeah.
We are speaking with Pat LaPointe, Managing Director of the Montana-based Frontier Angels Investment Network, Michelle Huey, CEO of Vim and Vigor, and Dr. Scott Latham, professor at the Manning School of Business at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Montana Rail Links, committed to safely providing transportation services to their clients. And Parson, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Scott, you mentioned that the pandemic sort of forced you to change your portfolio structure. Would you be willing to share with our listeners what you've done?
Yeah, again, you know, I would just suggest that, you know, anyone's investment strategies are personal and context specific. For me, now on the back nine of my life, probably another 15, 20 years to go, you know, I've probably reduced my risk propensity and have shifted largely to large cap, Amazon, you know, a lot of them, they're probably bigger than state economies. They're stable organizations that I think, regardless of what happens with COVID, a trade war with China, a recession, who wins the election, I know at the bare minimum, they're still going to be in business. And I know that the fluctuations relative to the peaks and valleys on their stock will long-term smooth out, and there'll be more upside than downside, in theory. For me, that's the right decision, although Pat's point earlier about more of a long-term perspective on the stock market as an explanation for why it's doing as well as it's doing is not wrong. It's how you define long-term, right? We're all dead in the long-term. Who said that quote? I think someone probably knows. But for me, that long-term horizon is 10, 15 years. And then that gets to the logic question of how long this economic instability lasts. And that is very concerning for me.
Pat, maybe you can tackle that. How long is this going to last? How long is this new normal? And I hate that expression. But how long are we going to be dealing with the effects and the ramifications of what we've been experiencing over the last 6 months?
In the spirit of the theme of non-binary, I think you have to break that down into a couple of different dimensions. Dimension number one is, how long are we going to be dealing with the immediate health-related concerns? And I think the answer to that is probably 18 months plus or minus six, right? I wish I was smart enough to tell you something more precise, but that's kind of how I think about it. The second element of it is then, how long are we going to be dealing with the direct economic effects that have arisen as a result of it? And the answer is possibly as many as 2 or 3 years after, before we start to feel like, and this assumes that no other major, you know, macroeconomic disruptor takes place in the interim, right? So big assumption. I think it'll still be 2 or 3 years after the end of the immediate health issues before we start to see a return to what we would categorize as a normal economy. And then there's the question of, how long will we see the indirect effects of this pandemic in our society, in our politics, in our culture, and in our economy? And I think the answer to that is maybe 2 decades. And we're going to notice it less because it won't be a direct line from cause to effect, but it'll be there, and it'll be there in the way that it disrupts industries and creates new industries. It'll be there in the way that it fundamentally changes the way people relate to one another, certainly in a business context, but even in things like dating, where, you know, the whole world is going to change because of how this period of time allowed us to really question our fundamental assumptions about what works and what doesn't work.
Let me ask Michelle a question.
Yeah.
In 2008, you were working in product management and brand analytics for a global pharmaceutical company, Takeda.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of disruptions took place then in your work world, and how do they parallel the situation now?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, you know, I've been in healthcare, biotech, pharmaceutical healthcare for pretty much my entire career, including with ViminVigor, which is technically a medical device. But in the 2008 Great Recession, healthcare didn't really have an impact. In fact, that's where most people were still investing their money. They're seeing decent returns. There was really no effect because of the way everything was happening from an economy and also globally, right? Like, okay, even if the Great Recession was happening here, the trickle effects from a global standpoint didn't happen all in unison the way this kind of COVID pandemic is happening. Everything all at once is shut down. And so you had places to go, as Pat pointed out, like, where are you going to put all the money? There were places, and healthcare was pretty shielded from that. Now it's crazy. I mean, I still keep obviously track of biotech healthcare stocks, and they're just insane. You know, what you're seeing from an earnings standpoint, stock standpoint, is just going crazy across the board. And even a whisper of a company that's never done vaccines before, who maybe, you know, going into the vaccine space, all of a sudden you see their stock price go up. They have no expertise. You understand how difficult it is, given how vaccines are actually created in the US, for that to actually happen. Also, with my experience of knowing how long the development stages are, even in a massive expedited review standpoint, you know, it's not something that you want to take lightly. So many people have died from this. The last thing anybody needs is for a vaccine to come out to cause other kind of health complications, right?
Right. You're not just giving this to 20 people.
No.
You're going to give it to 100 million people in just a month's period.
Easily, right? And so the amount of rigor that's required from a testing standpoint is high, and extrapolating it times 100, right? You know, across the board, from a stock standpoint, it's nuts. But yeah, from a healthcare standpoint, that it'll be really interesting. And this is what we're seeing a lot now. Actually, if you take a look at a lot of brands, they're kind of spinning their brand to be more healthcare focused or like wellness focused, even though they never had that type of messaging or branding or marketing standpoint before. They're kind of spinning and pivoting their messaging to be more health conscious or health focused. So I think that's going to continue. From my business standpoint, you asked a question of how long this is going to last for. Changes in this industry are permanent for my industry. And I'm not saying compression stocks. I'm actually saying like manufacturing, apparel, retail, just because of the amount of closures of stores and complete shifts in consumer behavior. It's going to have a permanent impact in which it's never going to look the same again.
So we're talking a little bit about where things are shifting and what industries might benefit. I want to talk about business owners and employees of businesses now. What should they be paying attention to? You're running your own 20-person company, or you're an employee of a smaller business. What should you be paying attention to, and how do you prepare? Scott, what do you think?
So the one thing I did find in looking at the last two recessions, and I would expect it to hold true here, and I see it even in healthcare, with some of the healthcare startups we're looking for. The smaller businesses that tend to survive at a higher rate have strong partnerships with very big companies. They just do. And it doesn't sound so obvious. So in the software industry, I found during the dot-com recession, there was a huge effect if you had a partnership with Oracle versus, say, someone like a PeopleSoft or JD Edwards that was struggling. So understanding, if you're a smaller business, what's the bigger cluster or ecosystem that you play in. If you're not in a strong position, you know, it boils down to the whole, you know, 20-80 rule. 20% of my customers are responsible for 80% of my business. You have to understand those. That is something you can look at in the books. For those businesses, that is what I would try to do right now. Again, I don't want to be a downer here, but I think the worst is yet to come. I really do.
Pat, you're standing in front of your 40 portfolio companies and you want to give them some advice on how to prepare for the future. What do you say to them?
Sobriety. Sobriety is king. Now more than ever, it is critically important not to be drinking your own Kool-Aid. Now more than ever, it is critically important to have really, really good listening posts in the customer and prospective customer worlds, so that you really do understand how much value you are or are not creating for customers. it's really, really critical to be completely sober about your cash flow needs, meaning how long is it actually going to take me to accomplish something critical? How much money is it going to take me to get there? How much money do I have on hand? How am I spending my money? Can I reallocate resources fast enough? Or do I really need more money in order to be able to not just survive, but to thrive? And so I'd wrap it in the sobriety bow, Arnie.
Michelle, your retail stores aren't open. There's this CARE Act money that's available, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you applied for like most businesses in the country. Mm-hmm. But for our listeners, where do you turn for help?
I think there are a couple of resources. I do want to kind of, go back to the question you were asking. I had some comments to make on that. That's okay. I think, you know, you kind of asked a question of about kind of what do businesses do now? It's really interesting because, you know, kind of pre-pandemic, you saw certain businesses who to the world looked like they were on top. And then in a blink of an eye, they are the ones who are filing for bankruptcy and struggling, and you vice versa, you know? So everything that you thought, you know, made sense, like doesn't anymore. And obviously it really depends on the company and the type of business and industry, but there's a big struggle right now with a lot of businesses. You know, option one, stay the course. Option two, innovate, right? And like when I say innovate, I mean in a pretty extreme way of completely pivoting your entire strategy. And there's discipline in both, staying the course and completely innovate. In fact, it may be sexier to innovate right now, right? Because there may be funding to do so or grants or just like, well, everything is flipped upside down. So I might as well just like take this opportunity to totally revamp. And I think it actually takes more discipline to stay the course. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not tweaking things. I mean, your strategy can still maintain the same. I'm not going to all of a sudden make compression socks and now make toilet paper, right? Because there's a need or something like that. And where you're going to see tweaks is really in the tactics. So it's the difference between strategy and knowing who you are, your customer base, really listening to them and understanding them and understanding how much their world and their buying habits have changed, much to what Pat has said. But then kind of tweaking your tactics for how do you go about meeting them where they are now, right? And so I think that is a really big distinction. And I think it sounds so sexy to innovate because that's what you read about. Like during the pandemic, this company totally changed their everything and now are producing PPE masks and all this stuff. Cool. Like I'm not saying don't do that, but I think don't necessarily fall victim to thinking you have to do that as well.
And I agree with what you've said, and I think that's all useful. But where do you go for help? Mm-hmm. How does somebody who feels overwhelmed by all this, do they go to a therapist? Like Charlie Brown, you know, Lucy had her 5-cent psychology booth.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously there's all different types of help. Mental health is a huge, huge thing right now. You know, there's professional help, you know, in terms of your job and where you go if you're a small business owner. There's obviously PPP, which I got and a lot of people got as well. Each state has their own grants. Montana's been great at providing grant funding for various purposes, and that's been really helpful. And then, you know, I think this is the key to really lean into other colleagues, right? Other people within the industry who are going through very similar things. I mean, I've got various forums and groups of other business owners in which we communicate on a regular basis, and you feel like you're not that alone. That everyone's going through these various struggles. And so I think it's a combination of obviously financial help, mental health is a really big deal right now for a ton of people.
Pat, in the midst of all of this, is there any reason for optimism?
Oh, absolutely. Almost regardless of your perspective. I mean, look, there's a lot of pain that a lot of people are going to go through, whether it's about losing a job, whether it's about getting ill or having family members ill, there's a lot of pain that people are going to suffer. But there is absolutely cause for optimism. At a very societal, civic level, the pain that we're feeling now about our inability to coalesce and find faster paths through this is going to lead us to redefine what we're looking for from our community leaders, So that's reason to be optimistic. On an entrepreneurial level, the challenges that so many entrepreneurs are facing right now to keep their businesses alive and look for those pivot opportunities, boy, nothing describes it better than the old saying of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it definitely does. And from an investor perspective, I can't think of a better time to be an investor than right now. Broken field is where investors thrive. Uncertainty. Now, I'm not talking about stock market investors, but I'm talking about private company investors. This is where we thrive. When new industries are being born and old industries are dying and the future is not yet clear. And the stock market is high, meaning that everybody's feeling flush with their IRA being safe for the moment. There's never been a better time to be a private investor. So yes, Arnie, tons of optimism.
Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, despite all of this craziness over the past couple of months, I think VibInvigor has never been stronger. It's never had this much clarity and focus as a company and with my team. And so kind of to add on to what Pat is saying, I think, you know, I am optimistic about the future and I'm excited about what this next chapter is going to look like.
Last question. What's the most important business lesson each of you have learned and want to share with our listeners about these last 6 months? You want to take a shot at it, Pat?
In a sense, I'll throw out the dichotomy of, in one sense, what comes to mind is surrender, meaning that I have to constantly remind myself how little control I have over things, because it's too easy to throw yourself into something, particularly if you have an entrepreneurial mindset, in the belief that if you just worked harder, you'd make it happen, damn it. It's far too easy to fall victim to that belief, and in so doing, neglect to understand that you are but a tiny little rowboat in a huge frolicking ocean. So that's one big part of it. The second big part of it is breathe. You're still here. And even though you're worried about what tomorrow might be, you're likely not going to do your best thinking while you're holding your breath and clenching your teeth. You have to allow yourself the opportunity to relax into the moment, to be able to fully observe all the signals around you in order to be able to take advantage of your greatest strength, which is probably what helped you make whatever degree of success you've had so far, and that is your instinct, your ability to observe and sense things properly.
Michelle?
I think the biggest lesson I've learned over the past couple of months is any entrepreneur, any business owner they're so focused on growth. And sometimes growth without thinking about profitability. I look at the business in a very different way now. My complete focus, I'd rather have a smaller business that is profitable, that's, you know, taking care of our customers, the team, and be okay with that rather than constantly chasing growth for growth's sake. And it's something that I kind of fell into towards the end of last year and was thinking about. And when this hit, it just makes so much more sense.
Scott?
Yeah, I think for me, and again, teaching strategy, I see some stuff coming out of McKinsey and Bain and BCG, and they're asking the question, what does COVID mean for strategy? I think Michelle did a really great job. And again, taking notes, I could write a paper here. You know, the planning horizon's gone from month to month. But even to Pat's point, I think it really is understanding the value that you provide to the customer. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but I'll give you a quick example. I was out for lunch last week at a fish restaurant here in Boston called Fishbones. You know, I was sitting there with my colleague and we were under the tent, we were outside, and they looked and said, wow, isn't this great strategy? And they were referring to the tent. And I basically said, no, it's really not strategy at all. You know, why is a tent strategy? I'm not here to sit under a tent. I'm here to have a meal. And they do really good food. And so I think it's important for people to always recognize, why is the customer there? And you need to meet them where they're at. They may be tense, there may be masks, there may be reduced hours, but why are they coming to you? What's that core value? And I think if you lose sight of that, I think there's going to be problems further down the line. And I did want to clarify one thing. I said the worst is yet to come. I don't mean the worst is yet to come this fall. What I mean is I think a lot of people are hoping there's going to be more certainty this fall, and I just don't think that's coming. So it may feel a little worse. But yeah, I think understanding the value to the customer and why they come to you. It isn't the tent, not the mask, it's not the hand sanitizer, it's the meal.
And with that, Michelle, Scott, Pat, thank you for sharing your timely advice with me today and with our listeners. Stay safe and take care.
Thank you, Arnie.
Thanks,
Arnie. Thanks, Arnie.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time when we explore how airports, unions, and airlines are all working together to survive the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.